Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. It is the 17th day of April. I'm Joe Donahue, and we have a wonderful panel, just an amazing panel of people today. And I'll explain the situation in just a moment of our special guest, and we have many, and we couldn't be more thrilled about that. We're also equally thrilled to have you with us, panel at WAMC.org. If you have anything on your mind that you'd like to, you know, chime in and say hi, or just, you know, rant, that's fine too. Panel at WAMC.org. I was out yesterday. I went to New York City to see Glengarry Glen Ross on Broadway. And the only reason I'm telling you that is because if just for 2 hours I was bathed in profanity. And and I find myself it's gonna, you know, I can't do that obviously on the radio, but boy, it's just it's hard now because it came so easily and so beautifully and so poetically on stage that I now want to try to mirror it in some way, but I will try to hold back.
Yeah, there is red button.
The red button will keep me in good stead. Now, let me introduce everybody to you, and we'll get ready. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here. Very excited about our guests. And,
yes.
You know, it's, as I say, as long as I don't read the papers, I'm good.
I understand. We also welcome a newbie to the program. We're very we're thrilled to have this gentleman with us. Bo Breslin is here. He is the Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Joe, I'm great. A little starstruck. I've been listening to Jim and Teresa and you for a long time, and I'm just hoping as I enter the major leagues that I can make contact in my first at bat.
Oh, I'm not worried about that at all. We're thrilled to have you. And and I do you remember who put you up to this?
Sarah?
Oh, was it? No,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We got a letter from somebody that said you should have this person on. And I was just wondering who that was.
I have no idea. It's probably I do a series at the Saratoga Springs Library. So
that could be
get folks fired up.
Well,
you can also hear him on C-SPAN, I discovered. So,
yes.
I mean, I think, you know, he's definitely in the big leagues.
The big leagues.
Checks in the mail, Teresa.
Talking
about,
I was listening, talking about Project 2025. He knows it.
Jim Hendler is with us, Tetherless World Professor of Computer Web and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, otherwise known as Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm good, Joe.
You have you finally taken us up on our offer to bring students in with you. You have brought three outstanding students with you. And are these all students that you personally deal with?
Yes, we have a small class this term on the history of artificial intelligence, but it has students from a bunch of different departments and a bunch of different areas and everyone from freshmen to grad students. So I brought a smattering of them.
Well, let me introduce the smattering. Marko Vucinic is a sophomore in psychology. Is that right?
Psychological science,
and it's really nice to have you here. What's the dream? What do you hope to accomplish with said background and degree?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I think I want to do something with AI, but at the same time, I'm trying to keep my future broad because I'm not sure what could happen in a few years.
Yeah, well,
or
welcome,
tomorrow.
Well, welcome to the club. Yeah, but yes, we're very happy to have you here. Sanae Charles-Shawala is with us, a senior in mechanical engineering. Is that correct?
Yep.
And what is what's mechanical engineering? Well, I mean, I know what mechanical engineering is, but what exactly is your interest in mechanical engineering?
Yeah, so mechanical engineering is a very broad subject. I'm interested in a lot of different things. Right now, it's like a lot of like sustainability, energy is also a big thing on my mind right now. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll check in with you in just a few moments on other issues here. Sophia Acquisto is with us. science and technology studies, a former elementary school teacher. Really?
Yeah, really.
What grade did you teach in?
I mostly subbed as I was going for my master's.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, got my education degree at SUNY New Paltz, then got my master's at TC, and now I'm here at RPI.
Well, that is fantastic. Did you like being a school teacher?
It was my dream. I love working with kids. I always wanted to be a teacher.
So now with the science and technology study background, what do you hope to do with that?
Well, I'm a history teacher originally, and I've been developing digital maps of the Hudson Valley to teach kids local history. So with this, I'm hoping to teach more history using educational technology and researching the ways digital tools can teach kids.
And if you want a really interesting one, ask her about what she's doing with quantum computing.
Well,
one moment. Hey, what are you doing with quantum computing?
Well, with quantum computing, I just received a grant from RPI and IBM. I'm working with Dr. Brian Callahan, and I started a project called Girls in Quantum, where we're going to be taking 7th to 9th grade girls from the local Troy area, bringing them to RPI, teaching them some basics in coding, quantum computing. And, it's going to be an amazing semester next fall.
Well, it's a pretty incredible group. Obviously, the bus with the dumb ones broke down.
We don't have any of those.
I was on that bus, Joe. I was on that bus. I had to walk.
I was thinking about the Secretary of Education who called it A1. So instead of whatever. I'm sorry.
Well, good morning, all.
I wasn't
all.
Calling her dumb.
It's delightful to have you all here, and I thank you very much for being here. It really does mean a lot to us, and we love having students. I just want to announce something that kind of fits into what we're talking about today already. That is that on April 30th, which is not too far from now. I think it's 2 weeks from yesterday. We are going to be broadcasting from the Hartwick College Shineman Chapel House with the Hartwick Institute of Public Service. And we're going to be talking to students. We are going to be talking to the co-directors of the Hartwick Institute of Public Service. And for those of you keeping score at home, April 30th marks the 100 days, the first 100 days of the second Trump administration. So we'll have a lot to talk about. We'll talk to more young people, students who will join us. Now, we do have tickets for this, and quantities are limited, and all you have to do is go to WAMC.org and look for WAMC on the road, and you can find out how you can join us in Oneonta for a special broadcast, 8:30 to 10:30 on Wednesday, April 30th. And it should be a very, very special morning, and we look forward to you joining us there. It'll be a great way to meet that community and to go see what's going on and to find out what the students are thinking in Oneonta, and a really bright group. We've had some of the students, we'll have different students on, but we had some of those students from that program on in the past, and they're just tremendous. I mean, not as good as you all.
No pressure on you.
But they're really, really good. So all of our students that come in and do the show are fantastic, and we love them and really thrilled that you're all here this morning. Okay, let us begin. Wow, I don't even know where to begin. I got to be honest with you. There is so much happening in the news, and it is, it's all very turbulent. And you look at these stories, and Jim and I have talked about this earlier, but it's you put the slate together. I think I put it out like 10 o'clock last night, and then, boom, all these other things happen. There's two stories that I just want to mention real quick, and then we're going to talk about them in depth tomorrow. The Jerome Powell story about Trump lashing out at Jerome Powell after the Fed chair's tariff warning. Since we have our wonderful students here and we have political scientists, and we're going to talk about other issues. But tomorrow, Aaron Pasitti will be here, and we'll talk about Jerome Powell and the tariffs, unless anybody wants to jump into that right now, okay. Then we continue with the tariff uncertainty, which, of course, seems to be something that is going to stay with us for a while. And then finally, we go to what I want to start off with this group this morning, and that is this idea of the court orders and the contempt proceedings that apparently are going forward. Judge James Boasberg has pressed Trump officials for weeks on their compliance with this action of Venezuelan migrants removed from the United States. And yesterday, the justice said the Constitution does not tolerate willful disobedience of judicial order. And now it seems as though contempt proceedings have been launched. This is to see whether any Trump administration officials defied his order not to remove Venezuelan migrants from this country based on the Wartime Alien Enemies Act and should face criminal contempt charges. Criminal contempt charges. Boasberg's order is the latest development in a broader showdown between the Trump administration and the federal judiciary, which has blocked or slowed many of the White House's far-reaching actions. The Supreme Court ruled this month that the plaintiffs in the Venezuelan migrants case filed their lawsuit in the wrong venue, taking the central legal issues of the case away from Boasberg. But this now goes on as to whether we are actually going to see what kind of criminal or civil contempt proceedings against the federal government. This is complex. This is rare. And significant penalties are even rarer. Any officials convicted of criminal contempt could be fined or jailed up to 6 months under a statute. And federal court rule cited all this Wednesday by Boasberg. Bo Breslin, we'll start with you on what you make of this. We mentioned the 100 days, so we're coming in to about almost 90. And, well, it's been exciting.
It has been, Joe. And I'll, first of all, applaud Judge Boasberg for what he's done. And I'll say, let me say three things quickly. And then one of the things that I would mention to the group is that maybe our gaze is a little bit distracted by Trump, and we ought to be thinking or looking slightly differently at the same time, and that's to the Supreme Court. So you have this other case that with the federal judge in Maryland that is a sort of a companion case. Here's my worry, Joe. Here's my fear about this particular moment is that we're not paying attention to what's going on behind the curtain at the Supreme Court. Now, there's no question in my mind that folks are both on both sides are excited by the unanimous decision that the Supreme Court made in the Abreu-Garcia case, right? So this is that companion case. But I read that as
and I'm just going to jump in, but this is for the wrongfully deported
correct.
Individual from the United States, right. From the state of Maryland, to go to this mega prison in El Salvador, in which case even the president of El Salvador and the president of the United States seemed rather gleeful to keep them there.
Correct. And, I'll get back to Boasberg in a second, but my worry is that Roberts, who's not my favorite justice, but he's an institutionalist who's trying to keep the court together, had to soften the language on that particular case in order to keep Alito and Thomas on board. And so in that particular case, he talks about facilitating a return of Abreu-Garcia. And don't forget, the court comes out in this unanimous decision to say, don't forget that the president has wide latitude in foreign affairs. That, to me, is read as trying to keep that the right wing of the Supreme Court on board in an opinion that's quite soft. So what happens when these cases come back to the Supreme Court and Alito and Thomas start to assert their power? That's issue number one. And issue number two, Boasberg, I think it's strategic. Now, it's interesting. He's a friend of Kavanaugh. He's a conservative. Boasberg is being tactical here by articulating the four different possibilities for contempt, right? We want to interview folks and see if we can get names. Then we'll interview folks under oath and try to get names. Then it would go to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice would ignore it. And then, as a last, as a nuclear option, Boasberg can assign a lawyer as a special prosecutor or a prosecutor in the case. My thinking on this is that Boasberg wants to drag it out because he, too, is an institutionalist. And the longer that this is in the media and in the news, the longer people start to think that maybe we are in a constitutional crisis. Final point three, and then I'll yield the floor. One of the things that's so frustrating to me is the court's decision in the Trump immunity case that was, 18 months ago, 2 years ago, right, where they said the Department of Justice can essentially be a pawn in the executive branch. What the court, no doubt, this is where the court was outmaneuvered by the Trump administration. No question that the court saw that as you can use the DOJ as a substantive institution to fulfill your agenda. But what Trump is also doing is using the tactics that he used in the Trump business to also win the day. So, you know, you have in these two cases, in these immigration cases, you have lawyers not being told information when they appear on behalf of the government, changing lawyers in the middle of the case so that they're a little bit out of the loop. You have the burying of the case with paperwork. You have different arguments on different days. This is the Trump tactic when he was a businessman. Make it difficult for any litigation, stretch it out and all that sort of stuff. The Trump versus U.S. case where the Supreme Court said you can use the DOJ, he's now using the DOJ as a tactical tool as well as a substantive tool.
So, can I ask him?
Oh, okay. Everyone wants to ask a question.
I was just going to follow up real quick. You know, the judicial enforcement entity is the U.S. Marshals Service. It was set up a little while ago, I believe,
correct,
by a guy named George Washington. Mm-hmm. So that's how long it's been around. And problem is, it reports up through the Department of Justice.
Correct.
So in other words, even if this contempt order goes through, as you say, it's going to go up to the Justice Department, which is going to find some way to ignore it. And it's unclear to me what happens at that point.
Yeah, Jim. So there's an obscure possibility that you can kind of marshal some regular citizens, but that's probably not going to happen. And quite frankly, the contempt has not been a successful tool in the past. That said, what I'd say, Jim, in that situation is, I think Boasberg, who's thinking institutionally, I think Boasberg is simply trying to raise the profile of his case in a way that allows folks to really get increasingly alarmed. He has no tool, right? Remember, Hamilton said the judiciary has power over neither the sword nor the purse. There aren't tools. I'm always struck by the fact that, you know, when Brown versus the Board of Education was decided, and I spent a lot of time thinking about it, the South did not desegregate until the Civil Rights Act 10 years later. So there's not a lot at Boasberg's. So I think he's using these sort of steps as a way to keep it in front of citizens around the country.
Yeah, and trying to lay a clear,
right,
precise record, right?
Isn't right.
But what do you think about Sotomayor's on the El Salvador question? Did you think that her writings helped a little bit?
Yeah,
to put some brackets on some of the language?
Yes, I do think. I mean, she has incredible credibility. Here's my worry about the current court, Teresa, and it's for my lifetime. I'm 58 years old. For my lifetime, the court was, you know, we define courts by who's the chief justice. It's the Roberts Court, it's the Rehnquist Court, Burger Court, whatever. But basically, you're talking about the real power is those who are the powerful voters. And for my entire lifetime, from Justice Powell to O'Connor to Kennedy, the power has been in the middle, right? This is really the first time since the Warren era that the power on the court is on the outside, and it's on the outside to the right.
Correct.
So when Sotomayor says whatever she says, in this case or any other, it's a lot of blowing in the wind, right? And so although I can take her seriously, Alito and Thomas do not have to take her seriously as long as they can get three more votes and Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch are legitimate, genuine conservative votes. So Sotomayor may...
Unless Coney Barrett surprises us.
And she has.
One can only hope.
One can only hope.
A few times.
That's that said, it's still, it's hard to imagine.
Now, let me ask, as you were saying, and if this is stupid, I apologize. But I don't understand. So if you hold them in contempt, who ultimately pays the price? In the sense of, is it the department? Is it the president? Is it the entire administration? Like, how does that
work? That's what he's trying to get to.
He's trying to get the names.
That's right. What he's trying to get to.
But so that would mean the specific person who made the call.
Correct.
And if that turns out to be the president of the United States, then it would be that. But that just seems so unlikely. So
it
basically they look for a sacrificial lamb, right, that isn't Stephen Miller.
Yeah, and I think that, Joe, I think the interesting thing about this is, and, you know, this is the media a little bit. If you look at the success rate of contempt orders in the same way we're talking about here, you know, there have been a handful, and most of them have been overturned on appeal. So this really is what I would describe as a PR fight, more than we're going to throw you in jail or fine you fight, right? So, and I applaud. I probably disagree with most of what Judge Boasberg says, not in this case, because, as you know, he's a conservative. He's been on the bench by Bush, and then he was elevated by Obama. But I would probably disagree with most of his things, but I love the fact that he's taking the fight, and he's actually stepping it up in a way that it becomes above the fold New York Times story. If he can continue to do that, the question of, I've said this many times, I'll stop here, but I've said this many times, a constitutional crisis will arrive in the event that there's an upper level court that the administration ignores. And by upper level, I mean Court of Appeals or Supreme Court. A district court judge, it happens all the time. Look at Judge Sirica when Nixon wrote him a personal letter that said, I'm not going to abide by your subpoena, right? The lower courts are ignored a lot by administration, but not the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court.
Don't you think this is just the bigger picture, though? This is a typical Trump team tactic,
oh, yes,
right? Because these are very, very important judicial issues. But it is, as we talk about the judicial aspects of it, you know, they're glad to have a fight over Venezuelan, you know, folks who are El Salvador, you know, gang, they can call gang members and throw out those words,
right,
because people aren't paying attention to the details because, you know, I mean, it's just a lot. It's overwhelming. And while that's all happening separately, they are, with very little attention, working out a budget,
right,
that has deep, deep cuts across the board and everything that impacts people's lives. And or they are this tariff fight. You know, the strategy around tariffs is really not good for the average working person.
Correct.
It's not good for agriculture. It's not good for small business. It's not good for, you know, a whole sort of things. And so this is the kind of discussion that they'd rather have in the front headlines,
yes,
as opposed to some of these other things that they're doing. It's not that they're not important points, and it's not you cannot talk about them. That's not what I mean. But this is a tactic he has used in the past, just like the tweet will briefly talk about the Federal Reserve. I mean, which tomorrow's a better day,
yes,
much better day, but the same thing.
Right.
The tariff situation is not going well. He came out, met with the Japanese folks yesterday, came out, made a statement saying things are going well, but they said not so much. You know, today it's Italy. It's, you know, the reality of it is it's going to be, it's a very costly move. The market's way down yesterday again.
Mm.
And all of this is a piece of trying to define the narrative and in the process just not follow the law, right?
Well, so
just not follow laws, norms, whatever, and distract from what they're actually doing in terms of whether or not, you know, the food prices our healthcare, which I know we're going to get to, or our transportation processes, or our EPA, or universities, whatever.
Yeah, so I'll say a couple things. You're absolutely right, Teresa, on that, on all that you say. One of the things that is so frustrating to me is as a left of center, more Pete Buttigieg than Elizabeth Warren Democrat, one of the things that's frustrating to me is that Trump's people are masters of messaging. So everything that's coming out in the last several days from whomever is about the Venezuelan situation is, oh, we're never going to bring back any particular gang member. When the question really is a question of due process.
Right.
So the language we can't even agree on the language, and they have the bigger bullhorn than currently the Democrats.
But also they are willing to say things that are beyond the norms.
Correct.
Because the people have not been proven to be gang members or whatever, right? And to me it's astounding. These same people who called the January 6th folks who were convicted of very serious crimes, an attack on our democracy, they're hostages, right? Yeah. And they've been pardoned. Yet these folks who they haven't been convicted of anything, right, get put on a plane in shackles and sent to another country. And they're cheering that. Yet these are the people who let out of prison those who've, beat police officers.
Sure.
And we're convicted. I mean, there's no consistency.
Yeah, I mean,
there.
It's the same thing, Joe. It's the same thing with regard to, attacking universities because Columbia and Harvard are not good with controlling anti-Semitism, right? Is that the reason? Absolutely not. Of course not. In the same way that bringing
fentanyl over the border.
Oh, come on.
And fentanyl, let's talk about the number one thing that does kill young people. It's guns.
Yeah.
It's guns. They talk about fentanyl, and yes, fentanyl's a problem. But what's the number one thing? It's guns. And they don't want to talk about guns, and they just cut the programs. You know, guns are a public health crisis, yeah, particularly for young people. You can talk about it. I'll stop yapping about this because I'm fixated. Why, if you're really worried about what's crossing the border, what about the Canadians having to deal with the influx of guns from the United,
sure,
States, right?
Right?
And all they want to talk about is fentanyl. They don't. It's not a real. That's just a straw man or whatever. If they really want to talk about what's killing young people, let's talk about guns.
And my only point, I'll say this. My only point is that they have mastered far better than the Democrats the power of messaging.
Yep.
Yeah. Anything you would like to add?
If I may jump in here for a second and
yes,
take the conversation back to Judge Boasberg and criminal contempt.
This is
contempt.
Marco, by the way. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Hi, I'm Marco. So, so I actually have two questions, but I'll say the first one first. So let's say that there is probable cause to go ahead with criminal contempt charges. And Judge Boasberg appoints a special prosecutor under Rule 42. What happens then is if the government is like, what happens then if they do get prosecuted, but the government is not willing to like abide by that finding? Or what happens if we get in a situation where the government it doesn't want to be prosecuted, is the best way I can put it.
They don't want to be prosecuted. You saw that they appealed earlier this morning or late last night. So they don't want to be prosecuted. I think, Margo, at the end of the day, what happens in that particular moment is Boasberg comes down with the hammer, right? And this is where Boasberg has the power in that moment to say either you're going to pay a fine, whoever you are, or you're going to go to jail for 60 days or 100 days or whatever it is. He's going to come down with a hammer. It's not going to last. That's the problem, because the history has been such that on appeal, those typically don't stand. But he'll come down with it. He's not going to back down in that moment.
And they'll run the clock, though. That's what Trump is. They're great at running the clock.
Absolutely.
But this is the real issue that's, you know, while you're witnessing history, because really these are questions that, you know, asked, not yet answered, right?
they didn't ask for that.
And then my other question was, can a court stop? Well, I wouldn't say stop, but Rule 48 requires leave of the court to dismiss a criminal case, I think. So what happens if there is a criminal contempt case, but instead of trying to fight it, the government just says it's going to dismiss it?
Well, the DOJ can do that sort of thing, right? So that's why I'm sure that's why Boasberg reminded the government that he can appoint somebody outside of the DOJ that's what he's thinking, right? These are stages, these are steps. Mm-hmm. So he's fully aware that the DOJ is not going to be helpful, and that's why he put number four in there. My guess is we're going to get there, but we'll see. I mean, one of the things that they are appealing the case, so let's see what the upper court says, the appeals court.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to some letters. We will get more thoughts on this, and then we'll move on to other issues. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We've been talking about this back and forth and Judge Boasberg launching contempt proceedings for the Trump administration and overall legal action. We have letters from our listeners. We go to Robert, who says, according to Google, the president has the right to pardon a person accused or convicted of federal criminal contempt. That would seem to make Judge Boasberg's threat of contempt pretty toothless. Then we go to Russ. The message the Trump administration is sending to the judicial branch is, you and what army? Then we go to Bruce. How long before Trump brings in his pardon powers to shield anyone in his administration who defies the judiciary? At that point, I think we'll have a different sort of constitutional crisis where Trump basically says that anyone in his administration can do whatever they want to do because he will pardon them. And then we go to Amy, who says, is this the same? No. At what point do the U.S. Marshals get involved? Let's say the Trump administration continues to defy the courts and then move to do something even more obviously unconstitutional, like turning the military on U.S. citizens. When would the U.S. Marshals get involved, and how could they? I know they answer to the DOJ, but are there loopholes?
Well, an interesting thing about that is that the military is required to follow all lawful orders. And so the question is, if they are given an order that is not lawful, will they follow it or not? That is the core constitutional question in answer to that.
Riddle me this, Batman, says Karen. She doesn't actually say that, but I just thought it was fine. If the contempt sticks and there is a fine, who pays the fine? Since it is the government being held in contempt, will the taxpayer be paying the bill?
Probably.
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, they're paying the legal bill to figure out who should pay the bill. Can we step back and just a quick reminder that behind all of this procedural legal issues, there are real people, people with families, people who walking down the street, we're surrounded by people without any, you know, identification who grabbed a tough person off the street, real people who, you know, yesterday a window was smashed to get a family out of a car when they were doing what they were legally allowed to do was wait for their lawyer, real people who were shackled and put on a plane and now are sitting in a prison in El Salvador. And all of the legal discussion is extremely important, but we can't lose sight of these real people who have, in many cases, they've been accused but not adjudicated of any crime. And this is not who we are as a country.
And let me also add to that, Teresa, you know, the Republicans have been allowed to go down to El Salvador, pose in front of the prison, do public relations things, and some of which are just disgraceful. And I would have to have that red button to talk. I'd have to go see Glengarry Glen Ross. But Chris Van Hollen went down and was not even allowed to go there. So that's the first Democrat to show up. And he said, you know, he said on TV last night, I won't be the last one to go. And he's now putting together, you know, a group of Democratic senators who are going to go down there and say, look, you know, Mr. Vice President, because you won't let us talk to the president. He's busy talking to our president to get a bunch of money out of the U.S. to host our prisoners. You know, you can't take the 20 of us and keep us out. So we'll see what happens with that. But they can, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
A little spin on that is that the Democrats are also requesting what's called a CODEL, which is a congressional delegation visit.
Yeah.
And so I will go back to what I'm saying all along here. Trump is who he is. The check on this is the House and Senate Republicans. And so it will be very important to see if the House Republicans and Senate Republicans who are in the majority, if they agree, because they would have to agree to have this CODEL, this sanctioned congressional trip there. And I think that if people feel like calling their members of Congress about something, there's so many things this week, but that's one of them that will really, you know, who are we as a country? Are we people who send innocent people or people who have not yet been adjudicated to a foreign prison? And if the House and Senate Republicans can't say, no, that's not who we are, we're going to go investigate this, then we have a really serious problem.
This wasn't front and center on the docket, but I am interested in just that case of the Maryland senator not being able to visit the prisoner of that.
He met with the vice president,
They wouldn't let him in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Does that then have to be worked out through this administration with their administration to make something like that happen? In other words,
if you went as a CODEL, right, meaning this, I'm sorry, but this is when I was working in the Congress, we call it the congressional delegation, if a sanction event.
Well, it sounds very fancy. We like you using it.
Okay, I'll CODEL. So if they go as a sanctioned congressional group, it would be pretty hard for them to say, no, you know, you hold the purse strings, and these folks are being held here using U.S. dollars, taxpayer dollars, and we're not going to let you in. I think that would be pretty hard for them to say no to.
But I think even if it's not an official CODEL, I think if you just see 10 or 15 senators down there, you know, that could raise that gets it above the fold on the front page in the New York Times, as you say.
I think
my guess is Bukele would ignore it and revel in the moment if it's not an official CODEL.
No doubt, one can imagine that the Trump folks are in the White House cheering that we're talking about this, because they can say, "Oh, they're trying to, well, they care about gang members who have killed people." Which this is the, you know, this is like,
they've already admitted this isn't one.
And there's a lot of questions about how many people on that plane were actually convicted, right? And it appears that many of them, not just one or two, but many of them were not convicted of anything. And as a country, we've sent them down there. But this is, again, distracting from, let's get to the education cuts, to the health care cuts. And I hate to say it's distracting, but I think that these are tools that they use. And in fact, even they're not deporting at the rate that they said they would, right? So this overshadows that because it makes them look tough. They're not deporting, I guess they're on par with the number of folks that Biden was deporting in the last year. And so all of this talk, we're going to deport 10 million people. And then, of course, the agriculture community is not thrilled with the levels that they are deporting, because these are people who that they need for their industry. So,
footnote to Teresa, what you're saying, and no doubt in my mind that now that she's quote unquote running for the governor, that Elise Stefanik will make a trip down to El Salvador because that's the photo op that really seems to be working for the Republicans.
But how is or should that be received here?
Meaning?
That if you really think about the human beings behind this.
By the way, we don't know that Elise Stefanik is going to be running for governor of the state of New York. But it has been suggested that she is looking to start an exploratory committee.
And Congressman Lawler seems to be paying much closer attention to his district recently, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who he seemed to be running hard for governor. And,
yep.
So there's signals that it suggests that it's in the realm of the possibilities. But I don't know. I mean, it's easy rhetoric to say, oh, these are gangsters, horrible people. But it's there's no facts there. Sure. It's a lot of rhetoric. There aren't facts. And these are human beings, and are we?
Just to throw in one other one, part of the reason to move it out of the states is we have laws governing the treatment of prisoners, right? El Salvador, is stuffing these guys into prison cells in ways that would never be allowed in the U.S.
There, exactly.
Some of the stories we're hearing about what they're fed, if they're fed, how they're kept. My wife made a very good point that last night that I originally didn't think about, and then I really started thinking seriously. I would be very surprised if this stuff really starts to get bad. Somehow, some of these guys are going to get murdered in prison.
Oh,
it's going to be the bad guys who did it to the good guys. And, look, the Trump administration was trying everything it could to get these nice guys back. But look what these horrible people did. And, it's not above them to do that. That's the scary part. I mean, you know, that sounds so conspiracy theory-ish that I originally said no. And then I started looking at what they're doing with Harvard and with other things. And you're just like, there's nothing that they see that seems to be where they're
That's why
stop.
I wanted to bring up the humanity of this, because these are people are tools in their messaging operation, right? Mm-hmm. But we can't lose sight of the fact that these are real human
people.
Beings with real families.
Yeah.
One letter, maybe two. Ellie says, perhaps the panel could comment on the possibility of state attorney generals charging the U.S. government with kidnapping.
Seems possible, but doubtful. But
understand the
creative thinking
the point.
There.
And Diane says, who sanctioned the payment of $6 million? I didn't hear about the Senate and House voting on this, or did I miss it? How hard to, not hard to do with so many pieces of spaghetti thrown against the wall?
That's an interesting question that I don't know the answer to. What pot of money is that $6 million coming from?
Well, oh, the humanity. We'll take a break.
I know. I just worry about the people.
I know. Absolutely.
And their families.
I agree with you. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Harvard.
Yay.
We're gonna
I got
hear
my
from,
colors on.
Yeah, you do. And we're going to talk to our students about this. And we'll welcome letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Then the arts and crafts part of the show will come in. That'd be great. We'll do all of this after a break and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Bo Breslin joins us, chair in government at Skidmore College. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler, is here. We have Marko Vucinic, who is a sophomore in psychology from RPI, the three of Jim's students that he has brought with us. Sine Trelshawala is with us as well, a senior in mechanical engineering, and Sophia Aquisto joins us, science and technology studies and a former elementary school teacher that we learned earlier, which is fascinating. We welcome all of them to the program, and we welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us go to questions of higher education, and of course, we talk about Harvard. The latest in Harvard's tale of woe here is that the White House has moved to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status, that according to news reports. And this is the latest in the back and forth between the White House and Harvard University. President Trump is escalating the battle against Harvard, as news reports Wednesday said the administration is pushing the IRS to revoke the school's tax-exempt status. President Trump had threatened the move on social media on Tuesday after Harvard refused to comply with administration demands to make policy changes and agree to federal oversight amid tensions over the school's diversity, equity, and inclusion policies and the handling of Gaza war protests. Perhaps Harvard should lose its tax-exempt status and be taxed as a political entity if it keeps pushing political, ideological, and terrorist-inspired supporting sickness? Quote. Trump wrote on social media, remember, tax-exempt status is totally contingent on acting in the, and then shouty caps, public interest. Jim.
So I was just going to say, Joe, you're wrong. That was not the latest. That was yesterday, right? The latest is the White House is now threatening to not allow Harvard to enroll international students at all. And it's totally unclear how they're planning to make that happen. But by denying the visas just because a student says they're going to Harvard, that actually is something that theoretically the State Department could do if they're willing to go along. And Rubio hasn't shown a whole lot of spine in resisting Trump's requests.
Can we just speak to the fact about the IRS for a second?
Yes.
Which is the federal law bars the president from directly or indirectly requesting that the IRS investigate or audit specific targets. So what he posted on Truth Social is barred by law from doing. It might work rhetorically, but he's barred by law from doing it. Bigger picture, I applaud Harvard and what they did, finally standing up, and I hope that other universities join in doing this, that there is talk about this coalition of universities, because this has got to stop. And I think that what the president of Harvard, Alan Garber, said, which is, quote, no government, regardless of which party is in power, should dictate what private universities can teach, whom they can admit and hire, and which areas of study and inquiry they can propose. And people say, well, you know, this is federal money. They should, you know, why should they be getting federal money? I think people have to understand that these are federal investments in universities, whether it's Harvard or Columbia or RPI, and with students here can speak to that, and all of you are from universities, I'll stop and start listening. But the research they do, the students that they educate are fundamental to our economy and our well-being, whether it's healthcare, transportation. Look at the students we have here and the various directions they're preparing for. These universities prepare the workforces of the future. They're often the spark for innovation of the future. And these are our tax dollars being invested in the strength of our community. And it's number one in the world. And he's trying to tear it apart, and it's got to stop.
Yeah. Let's think about some of the ironies here. One great irony is that back in the mid-70s, the court made a decision. It wasn't a great decision, in my opinion, but the Bakke affirmative action decision, right, where the court ruled that the University of California, Davis couldn't have a quota in terms of race and so on. And the model for affirmative action programs in the country at that time was Harvard. Lewis Powell mentions Harvard as the model that UC Davis should have done. Second irony is that the foundation of the great Brown versus Board of Education is diversity, right? We're gonna integrate the schools because, quite frankly, African American children see themselves as inferior. We'll integrate the schools and have more diverse schools in order for the educational mission of the country to improve. Some of these great ironies we either forget or the Trump administration doesn't care about. And I'm deeply troubled by that.
So wait, one more irony on this one. So, excuse me, the original demands on Harvard were things that Harvard was in the middle of negotiating,
right?
When the Trump administration said, by the way, that's not enough. So, you know, they basically were agreeing to a lot of the things with respect to the anti-Semitism requests. So they started being asked to have almost put some of their programs in receiverships. They would have to get their curriculum approved by the federal government. These things are crazy. And, you know, a private school, even like RPI, you know, we go through a state education review on everything we do. You try to take that. If we had federal stuff on top of that, it makes it almost impossible to get anything done, just timing-wise, anything-wise, any new course having to be approved, having to go through a six-month or a one-year process. I mean,
they want
let us
fight,
even
not
teach.
The fix.
Exactly. They want to keep Harvard on the front page. They see it as the prototypical elite Northeastern university that they can fight against. It has the largest endowment outside of a red state because the University of Texas has actually a larger endowment and strangely has not been come after despite anti-Semitism there.
All right, students, what say ye? Who would like to begin?
Well, if it's okay, I think I'd like to speak to my experience as a Columbia student.
Please do.
And
this is Sophia, by the way.
This is Sophia. Hello, good morning.
You're good.
I graduated Columbia in 2022, and my final year there, the encampments were a big topic. And something that was really missing from the media that really bothered me was every time I would go past the encampments, they were always so peaceful. And it was just students studying, eating, drinking. Sometimes they would give a speech, but it was always so peaceful. And the only time it would be violent was when the university would send in police to separate the encampment, to start things that then the media would come in and take pictures of. And
right.
That really bothered me as a student, and I was not surprised. Sorry.
No, I apologize for interrupting, but I was just saying we have those visions, those pictures of the police officers going into the buildings and into the windows and so forth, into places where they could enter the buildings. Yeah.
And they're terrifying images when you see them without more context. You see these images and think, wow, what's going on at Columbia? Like, these students are starting such violent riots, and it's such a mess. What's happening over there? And they're totally taken out of context from my experience. There were even some students who were against the encampment, and they would even tear gas some of these students. And the protesters would be going to hospitals. I saw the images of their wounds. They were being harmed, and this was not being covered. So I was not terribly surprised when I heard, what was it, a week ago or so, that Columbia caved in to the Trump administration's demands to not have their funding cut, and they're not supporting their students. So I'm really, really happy that Harvard had a backbone, honestly, and that they were willing to stand up against the Trump administration.
I guess I'll jump in as well, and I'll be a little quick about it. I think there's two aspects when we talk about revoking funding. And I'm going to preface this by saying that I'm aware that the second Trump administration doesn't exactly put morals in the top level of its priorities. But to me personally, and probably to a lot of people around the country, I just think it's morally wrong if you say, we're going to give you federal funding because we want to help you out and we want you to do research and we want you to, what, well, we want you to do stuff with it and improve your university with it. Only to then turn around and say, we giveth and we taketh away. So, I mean, I think that legally there's nothing legally wrong with them taking the money away. But of course, you also have to think about the moral aspect. I think it's just, I and probably a lot of people around the country also think it's just morally wrong to take the money away. And it's just being like, you follow our demands or no more money for you. And it's just really unfortunate.
And it's just so important that a school as big as Harvard can set the precedent for other universities that don't have the amount of funding Harvard has as to, like, some sort of guideline of what they can do if they are attacked next. Like,
absolutely.
Do you feel Columbia caved?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about any of you that want to mention this, but talk a little bit about the actual what's being lost here as far as the research. What's being lost is that, you know, the money that is actually being taken away and how important that is and how important the research is being done. Go ahead.
I can say something real quick. My first go back to the students thing. Like, just the other night, I was going through Instagram, as one does, and like a lot of my friends who go to Harvard, like they were like super stoked about like Harvard having a backbone, and it was actually really interesting to see like the amount of posts of appreciation they had. I had a question though about this, like what's like the end game for Harvard, like about the federal funding, like Columbia caved, like with research and everything, you need federal funding for the most part to do this research. So like, to what lengths would Harvard go until they, I guess, have to cave, or like, what's like the game? What would the game plan be in that case?
Well, I think that in that situation, I think the game plan is, I mean, Harvard was painted into a corner. They had really no choice because of the level of demand, which was higher than Columbia. And, as Jim was saying, changing the curriculum and plagiarism review of all faculty members. I mean, it's ridiculous what the Trump administration. So Harvard had no choice. The end game for them is they are the big dog in the ring, right? And so they have to sort of be at the vanguard. They have to be the moral leader in that situation. And so I think Columbia caved in a way that I think is shameful, but Harvard really had no choice. So their end game is just to maintain their place at the top of the heap.
So I was going to say, you know, there's an aspect of university administration here that comes to play. So the president of the university doesn't actually get to make the decisions. The president of the university is traditionally making a recommendation to a board of trustees to be able to take the endowment, for example, and use it for anything different. What I read about Columbia was it was basically their board that said no. And so I want to give credit to Harvard, whose board includes a lot of extremely wealthy people. Mm-hmm. It includes a lot of people who are very influential and includes a lot of people. You know, Columbia's board, rumors are there were some people there protecting their own relationships, things like that. The Harvard board is clearly putting the university above themselves, and I just think that's beautiful and something to applaud. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something where a lot of universities, some have signed on to these things. The Big Ten is trying to get a whole you can't cut us type thing going and some other things, but it's very hard. There also are a lot of university associations working behind the scenes, lobbying, things like that. But So by putting Harvard on the front page, the administration's trying to shut a lot of that down. I think Harvard can live for a while off of the fact that it does have an endowment it could draw down. They did quite well in the stock market. So, you know, so essentially they're not, there's no existential threat to Harvard for a while. There are other schools that are much closer to where this going on would be an existential threat. They're just not as, they're not the schools that are as visible.
But this changes, them doing what they did changed the conversation.
Oh, yes.
And it basically said, and it generated cheers, right? But now that conversation has to continue with other big players in the game. Other big universities need to say, okay, we will do the same thing, because this is bullying. And the way you can't acquiesce to a bully, because the bullying will just get worse and worse and worse. But these universities they're powerful in themselves, but their real power is in their alumni, yeah, who are, they held very high positions in a lot of different places, and industry. And industry needs the research that comes out of universities, because it translates into, and industry, more importantly, needs you all, right? They need to have a trained workforce, mm-hmm, and they need to start speaking up pretty darn soon, if they haven't already, to try to stop this. They're the firebreak, the industry leaders, the research leaders. And I think, but though Jim and all of you talk about, you know, as students, I'd like to hear what it makes you think about in terms of, does this create any worry or concern about what your research opportunities are going forward, and will you get into something where it will no longer be funded? What's the impact on a student's psyche is one of the things I wonder about.
Who wants to talk about their psyche?
Well, no, I guess I'll go.
Psychological science.
I guess I'll go first because I have the least to talk about. But I think it's because of my unique situation of being a sophomore. So I might have future research opportunities, but for the time being, it wouldn't affect me as much as like anyone else here. So, yeah.
I guess I can speak on, I'm a senior right now. I'm looking to get a master's degree. So like, I'm looking at colleges right now, and funding is also definitely a big question of whether I want to go somewhere if that school has like a fight with the administration. Maybe the research I want to do might not get funded. So that's a big consideration I'm doing right now when I'm deciding where school to go to.
And you're in clean energy, did I understand that? Right. And so that's a big area where there had been a lot of progress, and all of a sudden the funding's being pulled back. Right. So that... Not to worry you, but...
Yeah, no, nine of our...
but hey, you ought to be worried. I'm worried for you.
Not to worry, but yikes.
Right. You know, a bunch of our campus DOE grants are being held up by, for, quote, review, unquote.
Right.
And that's the other thing the administration is doing. So instead of saying, we're going to cut your funding, which then gets the university out into the fight... They're saying, well, we're just reviewing your grants. By the way, make noise right now. You know, it's almost like, nice university you got here. You know?
Yeah, don't dare say anything.
Don't let us worry you. But
remember why that is. Remember the pledges during the campaign where Trump met with a group of the oil and gas folks, right, and pledged. They gave him how much money and, you know, we're... So they're you know, and then he started attacking the Biden progress on clean energy and so on and so forth, and did a press conference the other day about coal or one of his fake
And let's also not forget that it's not just about research, despite the fact that I'm worried for you guys, and I'm worried for institutions like RPI and Harvard and so on and Skidmore. But it's also financial aid, right? So the federal government gives a ton of financial aid. So even if you're not engaged in research, that withholding that kind of money affects a lot of students.
And that gets to the issue of dismantling the gleefully trying to dismantle the Department of Education. And let's step back for a second. And what is their reason for dismantling the Department of Education? Because they want to push it down to the front lines. Okay? So at the same time, they say, we're going to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education because we think that that should be done in the local areas. And now they want to take, you know, control of the universities. Those two things are not consistent. But these attacks on higher education are not just these target attacks, but are across the board on how the student loan process will even work as they dismantle the Department of Education.
And I noticed today, Teresa, that Texas is now trying to push through $1 billion in voucher programs for private schools, right? So, you know, here we are back to Brown versus the Board of Education and the segregation, the de facto segregation that happens. The other thing that I'll mention is this is not – Trump's administration is more vocal, more message capable, but the rights assault on higher education has been around for a really long time, you know, since forever. But Buckley's, you know, God, Man, and Yale, the secularization of institutions of higher education, the move away from tradition. I'm always struck by the fact that people can't understand why higher education is filled with liberals. The mission of higher education is to question and criticize
critical thinking,
and that's going to breed folks who are liberal and willing to question the traditional notions that undergird higher ed. So I'm worried about all that sort of stuff, but the Trump administration is just better at messaging it at the moment. Reagan went after UC Berkeley when he was a governor.
I've got to pause you because we have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue on the subject. We have a lot of letters. I want to get to those as well. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have so much to talk about, and we have a wonderful group to do it with. And we are going to get to a few letters, and then we'll move on and talk about another issue that deals impacts the students that we have here this morning from RPI. Letter-wise, let's go to Rebecca. The bottom line question for me is this: what is the university like Columbia teaching its students by acquiescing to Trump? Good question. Also, Steve says, I'm employed at the Harvard Medical School as a professional staff member. The school leadership had a meeting with staff yesterday morning to provide some detail on the cost-cutting measures the school will need to take. In brief, they are planning what are likely to be large layoffs. I applaud the university for taking a stand, but there is going to be a lot of hurt because of Trump's actions. That from Steve.
Well, that can be stopped if the government doesn't move forward with these ridiculous cuts.
We have this letter from Linda. Does Harvard have enough money of its own to carry on research?
Yes.
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 Short term. Some things will be cut back.
So the other thing is to understand some of the places that we're talking about here. So, for example, most people in the country wouldn't know about the Broad Institute.
Right.
Broad Institute is a joint Harvard-MIT institute, which basically pioneered genetic research. They've been heavily involved in a lot of the stuff. The cancer survival rate in the U.S. is insanely higher than it used to be, largely because of research done at universities, especially places like Broad, because now we can do genetic analysis. We can literally say your particular breast cancer will respond best to these particular chemotherapies because of what was done at Broad. Right. I mean, if you know anyone with cancer, and virtually every time I've asked anybody, any audience, who here knows somebody with cancer, every hand goes up. Right. The universities have been where that research is being done.
The cost to the country of defunding this is very high.
Yeah.
So very high.
And what it is it's the early research. So what happens is the university proves something possible. It then moves into industry to get scaled up and to move out. So when you see these big companies saying, well, you know, we don't need, you don't see them defending the universities, but you also don't see them saying, yeah, to heck with the universities, right? The pharmaceutical
Heparin,
industry,
the space race.
I mean,
transportation.
On and on and on. Yes, and
well,
I mean,
and
all,
these
of the,
are...
all of these things come out of research. Start all of Silicon Valley. I mean, you know, almost everything that Musk has made money off of was taking things from universities and commercializing them.
Well, they're using the same playbook that Doge uses. It's the scorched earth policy, right? Where you're gonna crush the institutions and then build them up. One of the things that's interesting about Harvard is that there's bad diversity and good diversity, right? The Trump administration was asking Harvard to come up with what we would describe colloquially as good diversity, which is diversity of viewpoint. So we're in the first stage of what is a multi-stage assault on higher ed. And it's going to be, we're going to raise the institutions and then we're going to build them up with research and so on that is quote unquote less woke.
And they're
missing, so
but they're also, and Jim can speak, misappropriating the issues about anti-Semitism to do it. Which
yeah,
is
well, I mean,
terrible.
You know, I mean, if we want to talk about hypocrisy, just look at releasing the January 6th protesters and then talking anti-Semitism, releasing, you know, saying good people on both sides of, you know, white supremacists.
Charlottesville tiki torches.
Yeah, white supremacist stuff, on and on. But
you want to get to visas.
Well, I was going to say, that's the other way the government can really impact universities is our foreign students need visas to study here. That has always been something that the U.S. educational system has relied on. The percentage of students who are foreign-born in the U.S. who come here for education we were always an attractor of, you know, other countries talked about the brain drain to the United States. You're not hearing that anymore. You're hearing China say, hey, we can build up our own schools now because those students aren't going to the U.S. And they have put a huge amount of money into building their research capabilities at universities. See that around the world at some of the top places. They are happy to see our government destroy our universities and to not let the students in. But then we also have the situations where we literally have to tell our students who are on visas, Sophia, you might want to talk about this too and what it's doing to your department, is, you know, we are telling our students, if you're going to go home during the summer break, think hard about whether you're going to be allowed back in. And you don't need to have done anything bad.
And that's definitely something that's been happening in my department, in my school. Like, there's students who are afraid to leave to go home to their countries because they don't know if they can return to school. And that's very frightening. And these are fully funded students. They are students that are brilliant and contributing amazing scholarly works and have amazing minds. And it's just a disappointment to our education.
Yeah, and there's also the ripple effect is huge. So, you know, in my former life, I was dean of the faculty at Skidmore, and the reallocation of resources.
Hey, you missed that job.
I'm thrilled to be out of that gig. Although, as a political scientist, I'm not thrilled to be in this gig either. but the reallocation of resources to in this moment, colleges now have to focus on how do we maintain F-1 visas. And so we have to hire more people to be able to deal with students who can't get back in the country or faculty who we've offered jobs to and they can't get into the country. So the ripple effect of resource allocation and so on at a college and university is more than one can even imagine.
We are actually now providing foreign students who are going overseas with burner phones, essentially.
Yeah.
So they can stay in touch, but not have to bring their, quote, social media history, unquote, with them.
The AP reporting on this said the speed and scope of the federal government's efforts to terminate the legal status of international students have stunned colleges across the country. Few corners of higher education have been untouched, as schools ranging from prestigious private universities, large public research institutions, and tiny liberal arts colleges discover status terminations one after another among their students. You know, I speak from personal experience on this, but you have students that come to you and they say they're looking for help, and then you send them within the college. The college then goes, in some cases, the Bar Association and other places. And there's a lot of questions and very, very few answers at this point to figure out what a concrete answer is.
We have weekly meetings between our international student organization and the international students. We have, hours where they can come in and ask specific questions. There's a newsletter going out on a regular basis. All of that has been things we've done before, but we've had to step it up. So again, getting back to what Beau's saying, that's a small piece of the cost compared to losing a big grant. But we're going to need that money more and more. So, for example, I have graduate students who I have promised funding to. Right. The grants to fund them are currently not turned down, just
quote-unquote paused.
Quote-unquote paused. So they haven't even been reviewed yet, right? And, we don't even know. We've applied to agencies who are having their budgets cut in half.
Yes, and part of that, they're dismantling the reviewers, the staff that process those grants.
Everything.
But what is it going to mean for you folks, you students? I mean, what is the value to have this faculty from all over the world, fellow students from all over the world? What is your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think I also have a perspective on this as a teacher, a former teacher. I know when I was an elementary teacher, a big concern was what to do if there's a violent threat in the school. How are we protecting ourselves? You always keep the classroom doors locked. You know how to behave during lockdown drills. There's procedures. And now I've been talking to faculty, and they're wondering what to do if ICE enters the department building. They're wondering, how do we protect our students? They're wondering, do I feel comfortable putting my body between a ICE or an agent in the school and a student? Do I keep the student in my office if they feel safe? So there's a lot of questions of safety right now between the students and the faculty that are conversations that are ongoing.
And your generation went through the student gun violence and COVID and now this.
Yeah.
Yes.
It seems like
still
a lot.
Still going through the violence part.
It seems like a lot for your group of folks.
I mean, that's why you see so many of our generation who just says they've been checked out. Some of our generation says we've been checked out just because the gun violence, COVID, all that sort of stuff. And some of us say that. I mean, we don't, but some of our generation is going to say, "Look, I'm checked out. I'm done. This is too much for me."
I normally don't ask ages on this question, but are you over 20 or under 20?
Over 20.
Okay, over 20, but. For the last 10 years, sort of what we've been living in one form or another has been the case. So I'm just wondering, do you know what, and not that there is such a thing, but do you know what a political normal is?
Yes, actually. I actually was aware of a political world before Trump. So yes, I do know what a political normal is.
Okay. So, all right. I
had this conversation yesterday with a whole group of people who don't.
Well, I find that with a lot of my students, it's not a lack of historical knowledge. They know that, but I just mean of coming up and
their lived experience.
Exactly.
I'm over 22, Joe. And I'm not sure I know a political normal anymore.
No. Well, and that's the thing. But it is, and I think of students who are going to the polls for the first time. When you say,
your awareness, your political awareness, Sophia?
Politically aware, yes.
No, no, I meant, has it always been in, with the Trump?
Yeah,
the
because
norm breaking?
When Trump came in, 2016, yep. I was turning 16. So as when I started voting, that's who the administration was. So Obama was like my growing up years, but not like politically active years. So
right.
Yeah, that's my experience.
And then to answer like the political aware part, I got like I started watching the news like when Trump came into office. So like the normal political normal is like kind of like an ancient thing in the past in my mind.
Yeah.
Of like back in the day it was normal.
Yeah. No. That's the thing. And this struck me as you were describing earlier, Marco, about the fact that so many in your generation have checked out. And I just think that maybe one of the reasons is that they don't know that they're just chaos. They walked into this wall of chaos and they're like, all right, I could go turn right and walk right into it, or I could go run for the hills and maybe I'll do that.
Well, definitely. I mean, in my own experience, I was 12 when Trump was elected, but think about someone who's younger than me. They probably have never known a world with a political norm. Like at least in my case, I was alive for a time when there were political norms. But people who are younger than me, yeah.
Right. And
it's a
I know,
different framework for democracy.
I know we're going to get letters norms about what a political norm is, but I do understand. I hopefully most people understand what we're talking about. We're going to take a quick break. We'll go into extra innings when we come back. I bought you some extra time, Teresa. You get to talk about health funding.
Yay.
All right. It's my gift to you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Be sad
after
about
this.
That.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, I'm Joe Donahue, and you're listening to the Roundtable panel. We have a great group this morning. We have students from RPI who are enlightening us and telling us their perspectives. We have a wonderful group of panelists, Bo Breslin, Teresa Bourgeois, and Jim Hendler, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We have just about 10 minutes or so. I cut you off before. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So I was just going to say right before we went on break, why are we speedrunning isolationism again? I believe we tried this in the 1940s, and I think there was a certain minor conflict called World War II that put an end to it. So, yeah.
What do you think, Teresa?
I mean, I think it's a real concern. I think that what they're doing to universities, as people spoke about earlier, is driving people away from the U.S. to other areas. I mean, the Trump administration keeps saying that they, you know, we have to address the issues with China. We have to address the issues with China. But across the board, the way we're treating our education institutions are only strengthening that. The tariffs are only, you know, for the industries. They are driving industry partners around the globe away, customers away. They're driving them toward China. The USAID yep. cuts across the board not only hurt our agriculture community, but our diplomacy, and they are driving those countries. They're going to seek assistance elsewhere. I mean, we just had this.
We've lost Southern Africa because of the USAID you know, cuts.
Right.
China
and
went
blanking.
Rushing
Myanmar,
in.
Myanmar, where was the huge earthquake where the U.S. was nowhere to be found, right, in a response? So across the board, this is not strengthening us globally. All of these various actions that the governments do is a piece of a larger intertwined effort that strengthens our position around the globe. And these steps, particularly attacking our universities, weakens them.
Speaking
of weakening.
Go ahead.
I just want to mention, Teresa, what you said an hour ago, which is these are real people, mm-hmm. Southern Africa or Myanmar, where these are real people who are losing their lives because of our actions. It's not just about political diplomacy.
USAID, for sure. And what did they announce yesterday? The State Department's going to cut 50% of their staffing is the goal. I mean, how is that strengthening us globally? And Trump says, oh, you know, we don't want to have war. We don't want to have war. Well, if you don't want to have war, you need to have diplomacy. And you need to have interactions. And interactions happen at universities. I mean, I just got an email. I'm supposed to be on a call this afternoon with some of my former Harvard. We get once a month do a call. It's people from all over the world. Once a month we call and do an update with each other, right? You have folks, you've met friends from all over the world, right? Mm-hmm. And you do that in an education setting.
I want to real quick get to the fact, this is a Washington Post story about internal budget document reveals the extent of Trump's proposed health cuts. HHS would be asked to absorb a $40 billion cut. That's one-third of its discretionary budget. They're seeking to deeply slash budgets for federal health programs. The HHS budget draft, known as a passback, offers the first full look at the health and social service priorities of President Donald Trump's Office of Management and Budget as it prepares to send his 2026 fiscal year budget request to Congress. Teresa.
This is the reality of trying to implement Project 2025 and the whole range of cuts across the board, so that what they're trying to do is find a way to fund their tax cuts. And remember that those tax cuts go predominantly to the top 1%. And so to pay for their tax cuts, $47 billion budget cut in National Institutes of Health, 40% cut. And the National Institutes of Health funds research, and much of it goes to these universities. All kinds of, you know, the pandemic health research, cancer research, any medical disorders. And if you do that, you are cutting the intellectual capacity within NIH. You are cutting the university intellectual capacity, and you are going to set us back. We are the leaders in health research in the world, and this will decimate that. But it's also, there are the Food and Drug Administration. They are, drug devices, regulating food, tracking illness, all of those kinds of things that we don't know the details. Most people, how would we know? But these things, that the way that you end up with safe food on your plate is because the Food and Drug Administration tracks that. Mm-hmm. The way you end up with
pills,
medicine that you can rely on, that you're safe, is because of the Food and Drug Administration. They're totally proposing to decimate the Food and Drug Administration. Rural health services, money for Head Start. These are deep and dramatic, and they will change our culture. And I contend it will also hurt our economy. And
I was going to say, Teresa, you know, the other thing to understand about HHS and the National Institutes of Health, they actually have two components, what's called the internal funding and the external funding. Right. External is what they give to university things. Internal is their own research, much of which is focused on taking that basic research and helping to bridge the gap over to
translation,
making it useful. Yeah. Translation is the term we use. And where a lot of these current cuts are is not in the funding, external funding part. They're already trying to do that through other techniques such as overhead cuts and refusals to cover certain kinds of costs. But the internal part is also getting decimated. And I've been lucky enough to be a reviewer of some of those internal programs, which are staggering, just how important they are, how much impact they have globally on health and science. And, you know, things developed here. We talk about PEPFAR, the
AIDS drugs.
AIDS mm-hmm. programs that USAID is being cut, which will cause millions of children to die. But the drugs that they were getting were drugs developed in the U.S., came out of universities, went through a lot of
testing
processes within, well, not just review, but extension, you know, testing of different pairs, what are called sandwiches, the things that now people with AIDS can live for a long time,
and,
right?
And I have
was
to, but also,
not all of that came from this combination of external and internal, but particularly internal. So you're talking about things that not only have saved people in our country, but around the world.
And Trump.
We're just about out of time, but go ahead.
Trump says he wants to strengthen the economy.
Yeah.
These programs, just like universities, are often in communities. They are the economic driver in a community. Scientific research in these pharmaceutical companies, these are often the economic drivers. Health centers, hospitals, where a lot of this research is done, in those rural or even urban areas, they are the economic drivers. So not only don't we have the health impact, this is going to be a serious assault on the core economic drivers around the country. It's madness, and it needs to stop. Yep.
Jonathan writes to us and says, a while back I mentioned to my mid-20s daughter how crazy the last 20 years has been, starting with 9/11. She astutely said, "No, Dad, that's just life." You all have had quite a life,
wow.
And I thank you very much for sharing aspects of it with us. This morning we have really been, we lucked out in getting three wonderful students with us, Marco, Sine, and Sophia. Thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck in your studies, and best of luck in the future, and we're sorry for anything we did.
And
you guys better fix it.
And Nancy really Campbell, trying. If you're listening, thank you for letting Sophia miss class this morning.
Oh, that's right. Oh, do we have to write a note? My best to all of you. Thank you, Teresa. Bo, you're like,
you're
I'm
awesome,
sorry, you're
Bo.
Like brand new, and you sort
he
of...
sounds like a regular
contact. Right.
Absolutely. We look
Thank
forward
you,
to having you back, Jim. Always a pleasure. Thanks for making today happen. We'll be back right after this.